You're listening to Classic Business with Michael Avery, brought to you by Altron, there when it matters.
The Classic Business Show is brought to you by Altron, technology partners in your digital transformation journey. For more information, visit them at altron.com. Altron, there when it matters. Well, Australia's recent election was supposed to be a climate change election, with polls predicting a win for a left-leaning Labour Party that had climate change strategies as a core pillar and plank of their strategy. Indeed, Australians did vote on climate change, but they voted in the opposite direction. They seemed to vote on the economy, which is in the doldrums, and seemed to reject the higher costs that would have ensued from a more climate-focused administration. Are there lessons in this for South Africa? We're pursuing carbon tax from the 1st of June. Yesterday, we had the chief executive of Amplat, Chris Griffiths, quoted in the FT, bemoaning the policy environment. He was quite supportive of being alive to our commitments at Paris and various other commitments that we've made internationally, but also called for a policy environment that supported that. And he said, we currently don't have an ability as Amplats to increase our investment in renewables. And he was responding to a question there saying that there's no policy that allows us to do that currently in South Africa. There are actually laws preventing us from procuring renewables, and really that runs to the heart of what the big issue I see is for business. So where do we stand on such an important issue as a country that certainly needs to do its bit to reduce emissions on the one hand and create sustainable economic growth on the other? Well, tonight we invited a whole range of different organisations to chat to us. It seems people are still hesitant to debate the tax that's going to become effective on the 1st of June. So I must certainly thank the CEO of the Manufacturing Circle, Philippa Rodzith, for being courageous. Philippa, thank you and welcome again to the show.
Good evening, Michael.
On the line, we've got Andrew Gilder, our climate specialist from Climate Legal. Andrew, always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me, Michael. You've just sketched a PhD in your introduction, you realize.
Well, we're in a bull market for carbon tax news, it seems. I've also got Davi Ruit, economist at Efficient Group, on the line. Davi, it's been a while. I hope you're keeping well.
Always a pleasure talking to you. Good evening.
Now, Andrew, kick us off here. This carbon tax has been a long time coming. It's all about the polluter pays principle. And we saw the law announced in the budget speech this year was going to come into effect on the 1st of June. So just over a couple of weeks' time. Where do we stand? What does this mean? What will happen in the first phase that businesses need to be aware of?
So the big question is, are we going to get carbon tax on the 1st of June? I mean, that would be the fifth delayed date if indeed it happens. I'm expecting it to occur on the 1st of June. If it doesn't occur on the 1st of June, if you say to me, what does that mean? It means we'll get it within 3 to 6 months without question. There are too many other indicators that have all turned green now for it to stop. Answering your question could take all night. So let's just go to the nub of the issue, which is what's going to happen as of the 1st of June if we get carbon tax in on that date. The answer to that is not much. All that happens on the 1st of June is that the first tax period starts kicking down. So it's not as if anybody is going to be liable to pay carbon tax on the 1st of June. However, carbon tax liability will start being calculated from the 1st of June, and there are pros and cons to that. One of the pros is that a policy position that has been very long in the making will finally be realized. The con is that we are still looking at a legal regime that is quite complicated and is still has elements missing. The most recent development, though, was the release of draft rules from SARS for effectively how to fill in your carbon tax return.
Well, I think you've neatly summed up where it stands on the 1st of June if we do go ahead. Philippa, from your perspective as the Manufacturing Circle, you obviously represent big industry, big business here that's going to be impacted by the carbon tax. Where do you stand on the carbon tax issue? It's been called jobs killing on the one hand. It's been called very progressive on the other.
We see that the manufacturing sector is sitting on the bleeding edge of new policy implementation. It is a complicated issue in that on the one hand, we do need to have a sustainable manufacturing economy. But on the other hand, we do have an economy that is not a service-based economy. We're in the process of prematurely deindustrializing. And we do have high energy intensive users. And, you know, it's a case of balance, but we see a lot of stick and not necessarily enough carrot. In some instances, it's very difficult to change current energy consumption behavior. In the mining sector, for example, that consumption is there, and that impacts directly on the manufacturing sector, which feeds into it. So as the manufacturing circle, we represent a broad range of large industrialists. Some have greater ability to make changes than others. But it's a very complex and challenging area to navigate, in that if we were to change behavior or look to alternatives, those are not necessarily fully in place yet. For example, our renewable energy independent power producer program, we saw big challenges there from 2015 to 2018, where new power purchase agreements were not being signed. We've got one gas supplier, monopolistic gas supplier, and there's been quite a lot of activity there as far as the pricing of gas is concerned. So this needs to be looked at in a holistic way so that we do get a sustainable economy. But, you know, the devil is, as always, in the detail.
In those details, Darby. And in a way, I understand and support what Chris Griffith of Amplats had to say as well, and what is echoed by Philippa, in that a carbon tax is foisted onto industry and business while it's being prevented to choose to buy cleaner energy or generate its own energy at a lower cost than buying it from Eskom.
Yeah. All right. My expertise is on the tax side, and let me perhaps try to answer give my view looking from the tax side. So let's assume that we have a problem. The problem is, for example, CO2 emissions, and we want less of that. And then certainly, if you want to get less of something, then you simply tax it. So from a tax point of view, this is perhaps the correct approach if we want to have, well, less CO2 emissions as an example. But at the same time, I think what we need to do, and I think that is trying to get to what Philippa has just said, is that what we should be doing actually is to reduce the other taxes in the economy as well. Because what inevitably happens is that politicians always get used to a certain source of revenue, and then they eventually over time try to increase that source of revenue. So what we've seen in South Africa, we've seen a number of these so-called environmental taxes. I think the plastic bag tax is a very good example of that, is that eventually it just becomes part of the pool and politicians become dependent on this source of revenue. So what I would have liked to see is a similar reduction in some kind of other taxes. Looking at the tax itself, and I'm not really an expert, it's quite complicated. It seems quite an expensive tax. It's going to be quite cumbersome to fill in all those forms and to try to determine how much you actually need to pay over time to the state by way of these various taxes. So I can think of easier ways of taxing carbon emissions as an example. A simple increase in the pooling, I guess, would have done pretty much the same. So I think it's quite expensive, and I think it's also quite, at the current stage, and Philippa again is correct, is that South Africa is deindustrializing at the moment. So there is going to be a price that we will have to pay, and quite a substantial price by way of slower economic growth, or even slower economic growth and increase in unemployment and stuff like that. So yes, the principles, I guess, are right, but I would have liked to see a mixture of a reduction in some other taxes, as well as perhaps a better utilization of existing taxes that can pretty much achieve pretty much the same.
Andrew, to bring you in on that note, what happens to the money raised via the tax? Is it going to be ring-fenced? From what I've seen, it's not going to be ring-fenced.
So, I mean, it's an ongoing debate. The first time we saw the carbon tax mentioned in any comprehensive form was a 2006 draft paper on environmental fiscal reform, and categorically the statement was that these kind of environmental taxes are never ring-fenced anywhere in the world. It is simply a function of fiscal policy. Over time, and to their credit, and they've had a lot of time to think about this, Treasury's position moved and now seems to have moved back again. So it moved to the point where there was an acknowledgement, because there were a number of calls very similar to the kind of point that Davi has made. There were calls from industry saying, all right, well, look, if you're going to tax us, then please will you find a way of recycling this money, of ring-fencing this money so that it can be used to support appropriate initiatives like the implementation of renewable energy and the like. In 2016, Treasury commissioned a paper, an economic impact study assessment of the carbon tax, and some of the variables that were modeled were ideas like recycling carbon tax revenues back into the economy to support the energy efficiency incentives that you find under Section 12, capital L of the Income Tax Act. So that makes sense, because then you are, you know, you are gathering revenue that is in the context of polluter pays, and you are using that revenue to support initiatives that will lessen polluting activities. That and the outcome of that economic study was that the negative impact on the economy over the short term would be something silly like 0.015% a negative impact, you know, over time. That position from Treasury, I think, has faltered, and it's faltered because we have this enormous deficit, you know, in the budget. And so, unfortunately, I would not be surprised if carbon tax revenues are not ring-fenced and they go into the fiscus.
That would be a big loss, because there's an opportunity here to use the stick to beat more carrots out of the polluters, to then use that to drive the behaviour change that really is what this is all about at the end of the day. So without that, for me, it just becomes a naked grab for revenue, as we've seen with the sugar-sweetened beverage tax currently. Philippa, what's your take on that? Because for me, we also pay a carbon tax in the environmental levy, which is contained in the Eskom energy charge, don't we? So there are multiple taxes for this in the system anyway.
There are, and the manufacturing sector is one of the most highly taxed sectors, given the capital structure of businesses. So that's exactly the point. So on top of this, already it's a highly taxed sector. We're now contemplating waste tax, sugar tax, carbon tax, and it's the to what extent can we tax the sector until there's so little left to be taxed. And, you know, those conversations of being able to ring fence revenue and reapply it, yes, in theory, those are a good way to contemplate, but the reality of that happening, as Andrew notes, with the burdened fiscus is certainly not definite. And we certainly need to have a look and see at you know, where is the tipping point for a sector that also would have to deal with the cost of compliance. You know, some of these are quite complex calculations, particularly in an economy where some of our inputs are imported. And how are those calculated? Because basically climate change knows no borders. And here we are, you know, looking to comply and admirably so in order not to contribute more to emissions and have a sustainable environment. But to what extent are we beating the back of a manufacturing sector which is already under quite a lot of burden? And this cost of compliance, which requires, you know, we have a history of silos. We see it within government and, you know, having to work across divisions and ministries in order to effect this this tax, and also within businesses, where now suddenly you've got your environmental departments and your tax and your finance departments having to now work together to make sure that these calculations are correct, because that's your baseline upon which you're now going to be charged. So that's a lot of man hours in the day that now need to be applied to compliance. In addition to just keeping head above water and dealing with the challenges we have on the demand side in terms of weak local demand, weak global demand.
And whether or not we can even keep the lights on, regardless of whether those lights are being powered by dirty or renewable sources of energy at this stage. Darby, just to be cheeky, when we look at this, and I suppose that's the other element to this that I would like to bring in here as we wrap up and run out of time, is the question of Eskom's debt and Eskom's balance sheet. And one of the options for Eskom that was mentioned by Professor Anton Eberhard last week actually might be linked to gaining access to a special climate change financing fund from international finance agencies. And in that event, South Africa might have to undertake to reduce its carbon emissions quicker than undertaken in our original Paris Climate Agreement. And then the carbon tax would be seen as an important commitment to facilitate that outcome. So that just adds another element of interest to all of this, because as we know, Eskom is in such a big hole, it is the single biggest threat to the economy.
In fact, I think we need to pull a rabbit out of a hat here in order, if you want to really want to save Eskom, that they are so deep in financial troubles. I mean, we're talking about the 50, 70 billion or whatever that they still need to afford to finish the current financial year. But they probably need in the region of like 250 billion rand, really, if we want to save Eskom financially. But the theory behind all of this is quite easy to understand. What we effectively want to achieve, now this is the theory, we want to internalize the environmental cost on the income statement of a company. That is the simple theory behind this. So what we do, we charge a company, you pollute X, and we can actually calculate, that's your theory, so we're supposed to be able to calculate the cost of your pollution, we put it on your income statement in the form of a tax, and then by doing that, we internalize the cost of what you cost the environment, or what you cost the people of a country or the world, for that matter. Unfortunately, it's much easier said than done, because what happens in practice, it never ever, if you ring fence a revenue source, does it last. It always becomes part of the pot. It always be, and there are many examples in South Africa. The fuel levy is a good one. We had a road fund at one stage, and the fuel levy was supposed to fund roads, and now we've got toll roads as well. So it's not going to happen. And I think you are absolutely right. I think Philippa made a point, is that politicians eventually will just see this as another revenue source. I think what we need to do is to allow the private, the more environmentally friendly power producers to produce the power and to compete with the rest. And I also don't believe it's a good idea necessarily to subsidize them, because it's going to be extremely expensive. And currently, Eskom is forced to buy electricity from the so-called green producers and sell it at a cheaper price. Now, that is a stupid business model. And there's no wonder Eskom is in trouble. I think we wouldn't have had much of this debate today if we had a state that is properly run, the taxes that are certainly not as high as they are in South Africa, and much more efficiently on the side of the state, and of course, an Eskom that has been properly run as well, which we certainly do not have.
I guess
the problem is pretty much caused by politics, and not necessarily always by economics.
Well, the politics and the past 10 years of state capture and corruption, and certainly if that was producing greenhouse gases, we'd all be dead already. The amount of hot air that we've heard coming out of politicians' mouths over the last 10 years. Andrew, I'm certainly fed up with the politicians. Let's just conclude this on an important note here. Does carbon tax modelling consider our IRP or any other mitigation? Are we taking that into consideration here, that we do have an IRP? We haven't seen it finalized yet. We are promised by sometime around September, if you read the Minister of Energy statements. But does our current mitigation framework, is it recognized in our carbon tax modeling, or is it just dismissed?
No, absolutely. But that was done in 2016, so it was the previous IRP. Effectively, one would need to see a revision of the, you know, economic impact modelling of the carbon tax to take account of the IRP. Can I very, very quickly put two positive spins on this? Because we need the carbon tax, and notwithstanding the debate, but here are the two positive spins. You mentioned the renewable energy levy. The renewable energy levy is intended to, well, it's, well, the fossil fuel levy is intended to be phased out and replaced by the carbon tax, that revenue stream to be replaced by the carbon tax. One of the reasons being the Treasury wants to be very clear in the carbon tax not increasing the price of electricity in the first phase of the tax up to 2022. And then you actually opened the door to one of my favorite discussions. So your comment about Professor Eberhardt's notion that it's important to participate in these kind of activities because it can lock other opportunities for us. So the nub of that idea is that there are any number of opportunities that exist for this country as a result of the fact that we participate in the international climate change legal regime. The carbon tax is a fundamental indicator of our bona fide participation. If we are clever, and I will grant we need to debate that, if we are clever, there are greater opportunities for us across the range of mitigation and adaptation to climate change than is just represented by the economic impact of the carbon tax.
And Andrew, thank you for that. We will leave it on that particular note and invite you back to discuss some of those opportunities. Andrew Gilder, Director of Climate Legal, the CEO of the Manufacturing Circle, Philippa Rodzith, for being in studio. Thank you very much, Philippa. And Darby Root on the line, our economist at the Fission Group. Sylvia A is getting herself warmed up for you in Cape Town with the best in the jazz lounge. And in Gauteng, Anne Williams is standing in for Carolyn Stain's Classic Winding Down. Thanks for tuning in to the Classic Business Show, which was brought to you by Altron Technology Partners in your digital transformation journey. For more information, visit them at altron.com. There when it matters.